For August the 5th, 2014, we talk about The Recent Unpleasantness, Shadowgate, and video game cover art. Welcome to the 74th level. My name is Cole Ross.
My name is David Mysmith.
I'm sorry, your dentist is in another castle.
Yeah.
This is Jolaprendez. Is.
I'm Ben Merkel.
Yes, and you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. Thank you so much for sitting in for Dennis, Jolla.
Hi, I'm back. Oh, no.
Once more. Yeah.
The return.
This time, I'm still not drunk, but this time I do have alcohol.
Yeah.
Yay.
That's really the only way to do it. Oh, man. Slurredly. Yeah. So I'm trying to think here of any kind of like opening anecdote we can usually do. I will say to anybody who's going to be in the Pacific Northwest for the Portland Retro Games Expo, I bought my ticket, guys.
Ooh.
Woo!
Yeah.
Which ticket? Yeah. Plane ticket or the conference ticket?
I already have the conference ticket, my plane ticket last night. So that Ooh. is set in stone. And boy, that's going to be a good time. I don't want to talk too much about who's going to be there, but I do know that the one who matters most to me, Ben, you're going to be there, right?
Yay!
Yeah!
Woo! Yay!
Yeah.
Take that, Gary. I'm just kidding.
No, it's going to be a fantastic time. We announced on the live stream this past week what we're going to be talking about for the Watch Out for Fireballs live show. That is Street Fighter 2.
Ooh.
Yeah. I'm really jazzed about that. Woohoo!
Yeah, so we're going to record that and find some way to get it out there. I'm thinking because of the Patreon model, we're going to make it free for everybody. But yeah, it's pretty exciting, pretty jazzed about it. Not sure what day we're going to be recording or doing our panel, but it'll be a good time. So if you're in the area, it is heavily recommended, and we're going to be announcing and scheduling some like outside of expo, events and stuff. Word. Yeah, but that's not about this show. How are you guys doing?
Excited.
Yeah. Yay! Let's go with that. Yeah.
ready and raring to attack.
Well, that's right.
Well, why don't we do that? Why don't we go? What? Oh, sorry.
Go.
Oh,
do it.
Okay, cool. All right, sorry. Do I have everybody's permission? Am I good?
whenever
there's overtalk, I get incredibly deferential, and I've always been trying to, like, because once you hear that people do this, you can never stop hearing them do it, even in real life, which is people chiming back in after they're interrupted with, "Oh, I was just gonna say." Like, I notice it because I have to edit it out of pretty much every show that ever happens. But
which is why I think we should have. Oh no!
See?
Well, I was just gonna say.
So much
God damn it!
I was
what
just
if
gonna.
I just started randomly.
No, don't do that.
Everything I said no. with "Oh, I was just gonna say."
Oh, like, I was just gonna say that.
You guys are gonna give
well,
me an embolism.
Last time, everybody was so quiet. Last time, I'm just like, "Come on, let's do it!" Yeah. Instead of crickets chirping, and then this time, everybody wants to talk.
Yeah, everybody,
okay, never mind.
Everybody wants a piece of that audio pie.
Oh, I was just going to say that, too.
Yeah.
There's a limited amount of things you can say with, "Oh, I was just going to say," you know?
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, what that says is, I'm going to pick up where I was interrupted, except I'm going to make it impossible to do a seamless transition.
Yep.
Yeah. But no, now that you're cued into it, you'll hear it everywhere, and I just want to walk around with some kind of magic eraser that can just, just edit people's conversations on the fly.
Can I give you a non-sequitur that will completely throw you off?
Sure.
Okay. What I'm drinking tonight, I know David probably knows the answer.
Wow.
But the other two guys have no idea. I'm drinking a
Mead?
Buttery nipple.
Oh.
Oh. So that's one of those kind of like shots that I've always assumed was a joke.
Nope, no. It's really a thing. And actually, the best part is, here's an anecdote for you. My older sister is the one who first introduced me to buttery nipples. I didn't know what to say when she says, "Here, do you want a buttery nipple?" I'm like, what?
It sounds like it would involve rum.
It's actually not. It is butter shots and Irish cream. Butter. And I put a little bit more cream on top of my nipple. So
yeah,
there you go. So, creamy nipples.
What are butter shots?
Butter shots is just butterscotch. Butterscotch flavored alcohol.
Oh, like a schnapp kind of thing. Yeah.
Yep. It's a super, super sweet thing.
Yeah.
Butterscotch shots.
Shots. Yeah.
Scotch shots.
The brief. It's time for the brief where we talk about news and stuff. I said in stuff, and I meant like in stuff, like and stuff. Like I'm dropping my G's, but that didn't really work out. Who has a story they want to volunteer?
Ooh, I have a story.
Go.
Apparently, NCSoft has come out and is in talks to allow people to set up a City of Heroes private server, and also to allow the IP to somehow be transferred to people who want to make new products in the IP universe.
Let's use the City of Heroes name to make stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not finalized yet, but I still think that's I don't know, all the way around pretty awesome.
How bizarre is this that like it feels like we were just talking about how remote of a possibility this was.
Yeah,
like a couple weeks ago.
Again, like this was not a check my sources. This was just like me reading like on forums like, hey, this is why this isn't going to happen. Supposedly the servers were just like held together with, string and chewing gum.
Yeah, and spreadsheets.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I don't know. I still maintain, I think City of Heroes is maybe the best MMO ever made. I'm gonna go with that. And one of my favorite games I've ever played. So I'm really, really excited.
Yeah. Huh. So, I mean, do you think that that would come back in a way that is free for everybody to play? Or is that something where, like, there's going to be... I don't know. I could almost see them pulling, like, an Ultima Online and, like, the rights transfer to some other entity that is able to kind of, like, charge the money that is needed to keep the servers up and stuff.
Sure. I don't know. I'd be fine with either. I mean, it sounds to me like maybe this would be kind of what's happened with other games where basically just people set up their own servers. But honestly, as long as it wasn't like we're going to sell it to this company that's like $60 per month, all the money, and like twiddles their handlebar mustaches.
Yeah. Pets their cat.
Yes, exactly. I'm not sure I really care. I am kind of interested about the possibility of people, being able to use the IP. I really like the City of Heroes world, partially because unlike say like Marvel or DC, it was set up from the beginning to be, like DC Comics, that wasn't set up to be, the Justice League. So it doesn't really make sense why, like, for example, Superman doesn't just go solve all Batman's problems.
Okay.
Whereas City of Heroes was set up from the beginning to be a cohesive world in a world where there's, hundreds of superheroes.
Right. And no citizens.
And no citizens.
Yeah.
Everyone has superpowers.
Yeah.
It's X-Men to its logical conclusion.
Yeah,
it's X-Men if Magneto has his way.
Right.
Well, I mean, so with X-Men, shouldn't just natural selection?
I think that is the hypothesis that everybody's operating under, is that the X gene Homo superior will eventually replace Homo sapiens.
See, I guess I never... Sorry, we're tangenting, but I guess I never understood why that bothered people, like... I can understand if it was like, oh, the xenomorphs are going to, like, replace humanity. But if it's like, oh, these people that are identical to humanity in every way except awesome.
Yeah.
Like, I don't get how, especially when they they're the same species. They can interbreed. Like, yeah. It's like, I don't get how that's...
Well, usually people who are cast as villains are trying to subjugate the other. So kind of like, oh, we're the next step in evolution. So obviously the only place for Homo sapiens in our society are as like gutter filth who will like be our janitors and shit. You know, just as a way of like, oh, they're going to persecute me because I'm different. I persecute them because they're all the same.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Pretty much. That's my understanding. I haven't dipped too deep into X-Men, but I believe that is the operating assumption that everybody has.
I suppose that's actually rather insightful then.
Yeah. No, it's pretty good. What I've read, which is mostly just the Grant Morrison and the Joss Whedon runs of X-Men.
Joss Whedon's done X-Men.
Yeah. Yeah. He did the Astonishing X-Men. It's the arcs that run right after Grant Morrison's New X-Men.
Wow.
Really good.
Yeah, my problem with X-Men was always I don't particularly like Wolverine, and apparently everyone else does, so it seems like everything I see of the X-Men like prominently features him.
That's a marketing tactic.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's pretty cool. I always like it whenever something seems like it's going to be lost to the ages forever and then is not lost to the ages forever. So,
I also kind of like the idea that there's a company that isn't just reflexively like, no, my IP.
Hmm. There's a basis for that, though, especially like when you're talking about like trademark. If they don't defend it, then it defaults to somebody else. So this really must mean that they have no faith that it will ever create value for them in the future.
Yeah, I feel like this does maybe lend some support to some of the rumors I've seen that says like the reason they pulled the plug on City of Heroes, despite it being fairly popular, was they wanted to kill off the IP to force people, or you know, at least kill off the game to force the developers to develop other things for them.
Right.
So.
Yeah, they pulled the Milton, or a movie into the storeroom. No.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Ben, how about you? You got a story?
So this was something that I did not even know was going to be a thing, but it's a thing. So it's about Borderlands, not really Borderlands 2, but they're making a game that's set between Borderlands 1 and Borderlands 2. It's DLC. It's called Borderlands, the pre-sequel, !
I like that.
Yeah, I had not heard of this until recently, but... So apparently this is going to take place on a moon of one of the star systems near Pandora. But so it will focus on low gravity environments and kind of navigating that. And apparently one of the recent news events about it is you will be able to play as Handsome Jack from the second Borderlands game.
Right.
And part of the time you'll be playing as a clone of Handsome Jack or like somebody who is made to look like him, like a bodyguard.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So this is a thing. It'll be coming out for 360, PS3, and kind of last-gen consoles. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
I'm hoping low gravity means that I'll be able to, like, hover via machine gun fire.
I'm sure that'll be like something they build into some of the guns. This is my hover gun. I had read this, like, you know, you see just when you're skimming over your sites, you see headlines and I see Borderlands 2, the pre-sequel or whatever. It's like, oh, that makes no sense. And I really don't, I'm not invested in Borderlands at all. So I will just skim over it. Like, there's a name for that. There's a name for something that comes that is meant to fit between two sequels. That's Interquel. So,
like, I thought Interpol was who goes after people that want to kill McClane.
Yeah, no, I always get Interpol confused with the Postal Service.
Indie bands.
Yeah. I really do, even though I know they sound very different from each other. Interquel, which I understand they're going for like a goofy title joke, but is
hence the exclamation point.
Yeah.
Wasn't some choose your own adventure Borderlands supposed to be a thing?
Tales from the Borderlands, developed by Telltale.
Okay. That's not this.
That is
Telltale's
not this.
Telltale Tales.
Yes. Traveler's Tales Borderlands. That might actually be pretty good.
So yeah. I don't know. Have you guys checked out of the series, or would this be enough to bring you back?
I definitely like Borderlands. I like a lot of things about it. Explicitly, the story's never been the strong suit of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Potentially, like I'm glad this is a thing, and we'll probably play it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like they're leading with, oh, here's a way we can make the play more interesting. Like, oh, let's change up the environments. Let's take you off of this planet and put you into a different place. Like the Handsome Jack thing. Like, I know just enough about the series to understand that that's pretty much just fan service.
Mm-hmm.
So,
like playing the Joker in Batman.
Yeah. Which, fine, you know, I won't blame somebody for wanting to make their fans happy, but even still. Jala, you play Borderlands, right?
Just a little bit, and mostly just a co-op, so not enough to really have much of an opinion on it. So, I mean, I will possibly play it just on general principle of co-oping it, yep. But other than that, I don't have much to say, at least about that.
Yeah, I think Borderlands, at least two, it trades very heavily on the degree to which you like its characters, because mm-hmm. there's not so much a great deal of plot, so much as there are a lot of very characters with strong personalities.
Yeah,
And it seems like a lot of them people either really really like or just find very annoying.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd rather a game do that. Plot's overrated.
I tend to agree.
Yeah. Huh. Let's see here. Jala, how about you?
Well, I've got a couple of things, one of which is not really entirely video game related, but is of interest to listeners. A friend of mine, JP, from Pandamanga.com's Geek Life podcast, which is about indie comics, told me about something called Roll20.net. It is not new, and again, it's only kind of related, but it's a virtual tabletop gaming platform where you can create an environment online that you can play with other people and play tabletop RPGs like D&D and things like that. And it has regular text chat, including a dice roller, as well as video chat. So you can do everything as if you were in person, and you can also save the environments. You can add in art assets, you know, or you can use the default stuff that they have on their website, and it's free to join. Hmm. And I know this is of interest because there are a lot of people who listen to the show who like tabletop RPGs who oftentimes either can't find time or can't schedule with people in the area, and this is something where you know, you can kind of finagle it and work through it. And I know, for example, Geola was interested in it when I mentioned it to him, and he literally signed up as soon as I told him about it. Yeah. So other people may be also interested. So that's just one little quick clip. It's kind of video gamey because it creates a thing on a screen that is a, you know, whatever, but it's still based on tabletop. So
I mean, tabletop anyway. Is of interest to us.
So how are the art assets that you mentioned? Are they pretty extensive, or does it get repetitive if you play it?
Well, they seem to have a good deal of variety. Like in the intro video, if you go to roll20.net, they show some of the art assets and how everything works and, you know, all the different layers of the map and everything. And they do have, like, they showed off how many different types of dragons they have. And, of course, in Dungeons & Dragons, that's kind of a thing.
It's at least so half of the thing.
Like
yeah.
There's, like, 5 million different types of dragons in there. And, like I said, I mean, say, for example, one game I'm interested in playing is Kobolds Ate My Baby. And I've drawn the kobolds and, you know, put them all over the place. And so if I were to actually play a Kobolds Ate My Baby game on here, I would absolutely draw little avatars for everybody playing. So, yeah. You know, that's kind of something neat that I'm glad somebody finally did, because it's been a long time and it needed to happen. So that's one thing. And the other thing is this. Mighty No. 9's beta dropped, and Inafune and his team are interested in opening the beta via Steam Early Access in the next few weeks. Currently, only one level is available for Kickstarter backers such as myself and some PAX attendees who got codes from them. They intend to add a couple of levels when they release the beta on Steam, so they will be adding more stuff to it. And that's one of the things I played, so I will leave it off there.
Yeah, that was so taking the early access is actually pretty smart, I think, and that seems to be what most people are doing with their with their Steamables. It's a little bit frustrating because when you look at the banner on Steam now, it's pretty much entirely early access pre-order, early access pre-order.
Yeah,
it's just a very small percentage of like new releases. Here is a full product for you to download and play.
Yeah,
is it? I don't know. Is it weird when I looked at when the Kickstarter was going for Mighty No. 9? The thing that kind of turned me off was like one of their big headlines was like, "All our artists are Japanese." It's like that's kind of racist.
That says something to a certain portion of the audience who cares about that. I don't care about that, but
no. No, I backed it just on principle of, the memories. Like, I didn't exactly expect this to be some kind of riveting brand new thing. It's going to be another Mega Man clone that has slightly different gameplay than all the other Mega Mans. And, you know, that's fine. You know, that's... I basically backed it for nostalgia purpose, not because I was expecting it to be, you know, the greatest thing ever. But there are a lot of people who are very, very excited about this game. Yeah. So...
Well, I mean, Capcom isn't doing anything with Mega Man anymore, much to people's chagrin, so.
I really want another Mega Man, was it Legends game? That was fun.
Yeah, and so does half the internet.
Well, one of the things that makes this one significant, though, is the fact that this is one of the creators who, you know, created it, who left the company and then went out on their own and then decided to continue on what they were doing basically while they were at the company. And that's where that has some kind of significance insofar as the overall gaming market too. I mean, this is a AAA player who now has somebody spinning off and getting over like well over $1 million funding from all over the place to continue what he was doing that Capcom cut off.
Yeah.
So that has some...
Is it someone, like, legitimately that's doing that? Because I know, like, for a while there, like, every single game that came out was made by former Blizzard employees that worked on Diablo. Wasn't even Guild Wars supposed to be, like, former Blizzard employees?
At some point, yeah.
Yep. It was originally the people who started it. I think there were, what, three of them that made the first Guild Wars in an apartment? So, yeah. But, yeah, it seemed to me for a while there with all the Blizzard people were name-dropping, oh, yeah, former Blizzard employee. I'm like, man, they can't keep their people. What is going on?
Oh, you know, I was a tester for them.
Yeah,
it's like right.
Path of Exile, that's one I'm thinking of.
What's that?
Path of Exile, that's the reason why.
Oh, yeah. Huh. So I'm going to go ahead and do mine. I've got two that are like related and they're tied to the recent unpleasantness, which we haven't, directly addressed on the show. I think that, you know, talking about Gamersgate or whatever, like, you know, if you need us to make a statement about how we feel about that, I don't know. Maybe you haven't been paying attention, but why don't we just do this? So the one story that feels a little bit bigger is that there is an open letter. I hate open letters, like just as a thing, but there is just kind of like a almost like a pledge that, you know, is going around to game developers specifically, that, you know, kind of reads in part: we believe that everyone, no matter what gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, or religion, has the right to play games, criticize games, and make games without getting harassed or threatened. It is the diversity of our community that allows games to flourish. This is going around, and in the course of 24 hours, so we're recording this on Tuesday, September the 2nd, it has amassed over 2,000 signatures, essentially, of developers who are willing to put their full name and the company that they work for on it in this massive, massive list of people who are, you know, just saying like, yeah, let's, you know, at least on our side, let's kind of commit to ending the bullshit. Your move, gamers. Yeah. So that's out there, and that's a thing, and that, of course, is related to, as I said, Gamersgate and the whole Anita Sarkeesian problems, or the problems that people have with her. There we go. What she does is not a problem. And then kind of in relation to that, here's this kind of flip side to it. A notable YouTube celebrity, and when I say notable YouTube celebrity, I mean a person whose videos I've never watched, and he kind of looks like he would have a weird voice. PewDiePie? What's his name?
PewDiePie.
Yeah,
vaguely, I've heard of him. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anything about him?
Yeah, he's one of the he's like the most lucrative YouTube personality. Like he made like $4 million last year, on doing like Let's Plays and, you know, first looks and stuff. But he has made a move, and I think that this is noteworthy, to disable comments on his videos, just because they had gotten so bad. And essentially it was, this is not adding anything either to my life or to the work that I'm doing. And if people want to interact with me, there are plenty of other places to do it. There's just something about you guys having access to comments that makes you turn into shitheads.
Hmm. Yeah. I'm paraphrasing, general, of course. In general, I feel like the comment section of pretty much everything is horrible.
Yeah.
Like,
what about Yahoo Answers?
I would say even Yahoo Answers is often horrible if you read anything that isn't the number one voted thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and, you know, Yahoo Answers is, you know, that's a good thing because my brother and me is a thing. But outside of that, I've never really gone there, but I recognize the inherent humor value. I don't know. I think that, you know, if people have the opportunity to do that, I don't know what, I mean, man, there's just something about YouTube comments and comments in general that just engender really, really bad behavior. And so if somebody's willing to say like, hey, this is the way that I make my livelihood, and oh, here's this whole other part of it that adds a lot of negativity to my life, like, that's a big step, I think, because that's one of the major criticisms that Anita Sarkeesian got was, oh, well, you're trying to start a debate, but you don't have the comments on. Well, it's like, well, no, the debate that you guys are bringing to me is like horrible, horrible things, like, you know, threats, essentially, which she's gotten since day one. So it's kind of interesting to see these two things happening in tandem with my growing hypothesis that gamers in general are just the worst.
I think a lot of times what happens is that you have people acting with mob mentality because it's this big public forum and they can just throw a comment on there. And it's not like directly interacting with someone. It's throwing a comment out there for everybody to start a flame war over. And, you know, they're just trying to be incendiary and get some kind of reaction. And that's, to me, a lot of what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also think it, you know, it kind of tends to feed, you know, when you see the other side basically come out and say, like, our game plan is that you guys lose.
Can you say who the players are in this? Because I don't know who wins and who loses in this.
You know, I see all the time discussions where, say, something that'll be like something related to religion, and one of the comments will be, you know, say like, anyone that believes in religion is an idiot and that should be against the law, et cetera, and that innately creates the stance of atheists are innately the enemy of anyone on the other side. You know, it's one bad comment tends to set up the commenter's side as innately an enemy, as opposed to actually a rational living human being that, you know, you could actually have debate with. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's what we've been saying all along, which is, you know, kind of immature means of, you know, for lack of a better word, debate, or let's just say engagement, or any kind of, like, you know, discussion around a fundamental, you know, disagreement that you might have, like, immediately sides toward this crazy binary, you know, that, like, that immediately just, you know, sides one, you know, one side against the other, you know, for lack of a more elegant way to say it. And that is that is just something that's been incredibly depressing about this, which, you know, which is how adversarial it gets, and how much you see, especially in people who are making their own, you know, kind of like YouTube videos and stuff, what that drives people towards, which is I'm not the kind of person who is going to say that the truth is somewhere in the middle. Sometimes the truth is objectively on one side, right? Or more towards one side on the other. So when I say, like, any kind of moderation, I don't mean like a milquetoast centrism. What I mean is, what it drives people towards is, you need to be as loud as possible and as single-minded in how aggressive you are, because otherwise you're not actually building and forwarding your brand, because so much of this is self-promotional, and so much of this turns into, how can I be this firebrand personality that will get people to pay attention to me? And you don't get that by saying, oh, well, you know, it's actually pretty complicated, and, you know, like any kind of admission that the issue is more complicated than, you know, it immediately presents itself as, is just a way for people not to, you know, say, like, hey, don't listen to me, guys.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think, I just think in general, you know, this has actually now been years ago, but I, you know, read an article once that basically the point it made is that the comment section, to a large degree, was an experiment. You know, this was talking on news program, news sites. It was, you know, the idea was that, you know, oh, this will be a forum people can talk about, you know, this news article, and that just hasn't worked, and it's time to move on.
Yeah. Well,
and, like, I think, like, forums, I think the internet should still be about discussion, but it seems to me like just across the board, comments haven't worked.
Mm-hmm. No, no, and I think that to my mind, the thing that I've heard is that sites like, you know, news sites or whatever, like anybody who is really jockeying for page views, keeps comments around specifically because it does get them. So, you know, if each person engages in the comments, you know, each of those refreshes that they get to kind of take part in the conversation, or even just read the article once, maybe several pages of it, and then go down and enter their name. Oh, that's a couple of page views. And then they put in their response. That's another page view. Like, it's a way to juice the numbers and, you know, in order to sell, like, ad spots. So, as you know, my working hypothesis is that the internet is the way it is primarily because that's how it's been monetized. When in reality, the way that those discussions need to take place, or the ideal way, is almost the way that Tumblr does it, which is you don't leave a tag on somebody, you don't leave a, you know, a comment on somebody's post. You actually, like, write your own thing in response to it that links back to it. Like, you know, it's not the case where, like, you know, there's no shortage of forums for people to say these hateful things, right? or even to just say what they, you know, what they want to say, to have their piece. Nobody is for lack of access to you know, to a platform right now. And I think that back when comment sections, you know, became the norm, you know, it was like with guest books, like, okay, let's give everybody the ability to have a voice. Well, we have the ability to have a voice. Why don't we take away people's spray paint cans and, you know, stop them from bringing the horse shit right to somebody's front door, if it's horse shit that they intend to bring?
True. And I think the one difficulty in this particular thing is, I would say the one area where it seems to me comments are sometimes helpful would be, you know, art type things, you know, where I do occasionally see, you know, say where there's a YouTube video and people comment, you know, actually legitimately on the video, mm-hmm. instead of just fighting. And that's, I feel like that's one problem is that specifically YouTube would probably be some place where comments actually do have a place, but unfortunately they're still abused even there.
Yeah. I love the way SoundCloud does it, actually, which is to every comment needs to have a marker to it. so that like you're actually commenting on a specific thing. So for songs, you know, it's a way to say, oh, dude, this like what you did right here just blew my mind. And for podcasts and stuff, it's like a way to say, well, this thing right here, you know, like let's actually correct you. But even that still like that
thing blew. Yeah.
even that still, you know, that information, like that discussion is important for the creator and the person who is like watching this thing and critiquing it. There really isn't that much kind of use for that to be out in the public. So I can only speak to my own personal experience with this. The vast majority of the interaction that we get on our shows is via the contact form. You know, there are comment sections on each episode, and we have the SoundCloud files and stuff like that where everybody can go, but most people are writing directly in. And that is, you know, the most constructive stuff that I've seen, right?
That's very useful.
Yeah. So, like, even in that case, I would argue that people don't necessarily need to have that aired out in the open. And that leads to, you know, in the worst case scenario, which is almost always, to what Jala said, which is you just have that one guy who throws the one rock, and all of a sudden you have just a crazy shit show happening.
Although, to be fair, I mean, I guess what I'm thinking is more, it seems to me like commentary is a part of appreciating art. I guess it's kind of more what I was saying. So not so much like highly constructive, but I still feel like, to a significant degree, that's what this podcast is us, you know,
right,
doing the comment section for games.
Oh God, I hope that we're more than that.
Well, you know what I mean.
Yeah, but I mean, like, but like, we don't record these as .wav files and like mail them to every like put these at the end of every other creation. Like this isn't tacked on after the credits on every single video game. You know, I really think I
do download it and send it to EA every week.
you're just making your own mods.
I also
they receive a CD in the mail.
Oh, that's not weird. Ben,
Ron Paul 2012.
Thank you. First,
that's how we should start every podcast.
First, Ron Paul 2012. Dude, that election was like wicked long ago, dude. Do you have any thoughts on this, Ben? You've been kind of quiet.
I do. So I think part of the problem is like anonymity and my speech, but anonymity on the internet. One thing that kind of addresses this issue is like think of like Reddit comments where it's kind of peer reviewed. So if someone says something super hateful, you can just downvote it, you know? Mm-hmm. Not saying that that's the best alternative. Like you don't want to filter things, like you don't want to block out information, you know, but you need some sort of evaluation system from peers
but the problem is Reddit doesn't block out things that are hateful. They block out things that are unpopular.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so it is very dependent upon the audience who's using it. So if they are not rational, then yes, you might not get the type of cream that you would want to rise to the top.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think just in general, humanity is not rational. I mean, I feel like that's why the internet was to a certain degree designed to be anonymous, is based on the idea that you should always be able to make comments without having to worry about retribution,
without having to answer for the bullshit that you put out there. Sorry, that isn't constructive. I'm kind of the opinion that like unless you are a dissident in Iran, you probably don't need anonymity on the internet.
Yeah, I strongly disagree.
Okay. Yeah. No, I just I don't know. I've seen nothing good come of it, I suppose. But I don't know. I'm speaking in the moment here, and this is something that, like, I don't feel as crappy about it as I did before. Like, in general, it kind of seems like people are coming around and everything is kind of settled back into the status quo a little bit. And it's not that it's a great status quo, but you have positive things like those two stories I just dropped here. And yeah, but even still, it is something that kind of, like, weighs heavy on me because it has a real impact. You know, this is the, you know, these things are going on in our neighborhood, you know, and it's not great when people are in there wrecking stuff up. You just kind of want things to be peaceful. I don't know. Maybe I'm an old man and maybe my brand isn't strong enough. I'm not yelling loud enough, but should I yell more, guys?
You should go to sleep.
Yeah, I really should. I haven't slept in days.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where we interact with you guys. And thank you so kindly for writing in and answering the question, which this week was asked by Dennis. He says, "Hey, let's judge games based on their covers. What is your favorite and or least favorite box art?" Yeah.
I see what he did there.
Yeah, and this is a conversation that I like to have, so I'm excited to jump right in. Jala, what does Chad say?
Chad says, "Best Dark Souls OBV Amorite has the best box art, and the Japanese box art is unreal in comparison to what they got in the States." And then there's links, but I also love the Askri Tree steel case and box art.
Assassin's Creed
and
Tree.
Games links. Yeah. I know. I just had to read it the way you wrote it because it's awesome.
Okay.
Worse, any box art for COD Blops or Gran Turismo.
Yeah.
And then, of course, lots and lots of links. Everybody gave links, by the way, or most everybody gave links.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about this one. It's just that it's so, like, you can immediately see what they're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I don't know that I agree on the Gran Turismo ones. I think that they're simple, but I like that about them. They're kind of understated.
Yeah, I really like, it's kind of funny to me, I really like both. I'm assuming the Dark Souls one he linked is the Japanese, right?
Yeah.
So I actually really like both that one and the American one, although I do agree, I think the Japanese one is maybe a little bit more true to the game.
Yeah. I don't know where they get the blues in the American one. Like how it's the crazy glowy Elite Knight guy. There's almost no blue in the game.
I don't know. Although I love that armor set.
Yeah. That's even great.
And that's why.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and that's why they put it on the cover.
Yeah. Pretty cool character who wears it, too. Yeah. It's from Astora. Yeah. I think that feeds into it. So, like, speaking to the difference between the Japanese and the American, like, that for me is always the line that all of this gets separated on. Because the best... the best and the worst is often shared by the same title.
Yeah, I think to throw in a obvious one that I don't actually want to talk about that much, but I feel like it's so obvious and you say it, would be Ico, where the American one is considered one of the worst cover arts of all time, and the Japanese one is considered one of the best.
Yeah. Well, the American one is so bad just because it looks like a Photoshop job. Like, it looks like they were trying to make the least inspired straight to DVD movie cover they possibly could.
Well, and it also, like, doesn't really accurately depict what the game is at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For real. But then the Japanese one actually has, like, it's this awesome, like, it's almost like a charcoal and watercolor kind of look to it it takes the color palette from the main game and uses it really well, and it kind of shows the scale. It has Ico and Yorta kind of running really small off in the distance with a long shadow drawn out of them. Like, yeah, it's perfect, right? And beautiful.
It's based on what is it? Actual painter. It's based on one moment.
Cursor to Dolly. I forget his name too.
Yeah, and I'm gonna link the painting it's based off of.
Yeah.
The Nostalgia of the Infinite.
Oh yeah, it totally is. That's pretty good. Yeah, by Giorgio del Chirico. Yeah. Yeah, so this is just going to be a very heavy links. I'm going to do lots of links of note for this episode. But yeah, it totally is like that. Man, I love that painting. Huh.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, now a podcast about art. After finding that out the first time, I went and looked at some of his other stuff. And actually, he does a lot of really cool stuff. It's all that same kind of like pseudo-lonely type of look.
Mm-hmm.
But he does some really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Neat. Let's see here. Ben, what's Jeff say?
Jeff says the best box art is definitely the PAL Resident Evil. Resident Evil! box art. The red background splashed with black forested trees and a lone chainsaw wielding man is just a fearsome spectacle, perfectly capturing at least a very memorable part of the game. I will double down on that. That box art is pretty awesome.
Yeah, it really is.
But it is a very small part of the game, though, given how much ground that game covers.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it does look cool, though. Yeah. Of course, worst box art goes to the North America Mega Man. Just classic example of bad.
Although I have to say, in general, I think some of the comments show that I'm in the minority. I sort of like the box art of particularly on the pixel era games, where the box art was like, here's what we envision is happening in this game, versus actually representing what the game looks like.
Yeah, when the concept art was better than the actual art.
Yeah. I mean, to give you an idea again of what the intention is when you had to bring a certain amount of imagination to it.
Right.
And I'm idealizing because I grew up at the very tail end of that, kind of thing. But even then, if a game was, the cover art was evocative to me, the best cover art was evocative of how you should feel when you're looking at this.
Right.
Right.
I think some of the Zelda games did pretty good jobs of that.
Yeah. Well, the tragedy of the Mega Man box art is that they had perfectly serviceable, really great anime-inspired chibi art for the characters. The concept art would have been perfect for it, except it wasn't marketable enough to American audiences.
No one in America will ever go for this anime crap.
No. Why do you think that, just do a search for it, Kirby is always angry in America.
Yeah.
If you look at the box art for any Kirby video game, in America, he will be all scowly and I'm a fighter and I'm gonna be out here. But in Japan, he's a happy pink puff ball, which is what he is.
Although I do think one of them I really liked as a kid was Dragon Warrior, which is the actual concept art and in Japan is the. All done by the same guy that does all of Dragon Ball Z and Dragon Ball, I guess, in general. So I feel like that's a weird thing where probably from a semi-objective standpoint, the Japanese stuff was better. Although, I don't know, as a kid, I really liked more of the kind of the high fantasy, this looks like it belongs on a... Forgotten Realms cover, maybe the cover of a metal band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see here. Why don't one of you? Well, the next one is yours, Jala, right? So when you wrote this, you didn't know that you were going to be.
I didn't know I was going to be on the show. So
yeah. So why don't you
tell
us?
I think somebody else needs to. Well, unless you want me to actually read it myself, I think it would be kind of funny.
You don't need to read it, but you can say here's what I think. You don't have to read it out loud.
Well, I was very, very quiet while you guys were throwing out your ideas about the Pixel era, because mine is also about the Pixel era, but it's a different spin on it. Here, for me, I was very disappointed very often when I would pick up box art over at Blockbuster or wherever I was renting video games from, and I would pick it up and it'd be my one game for the week, and I'm like, oh, this looks really cool, and I'm like, well, I don't know. Let me go ahead and give it a shot. And then I try it, and then it's a completely crappy game. And this happened more often than not, where the box art was cool, but it's like they sunk all of their money into that and not into the actual game. And so, you know, a lot of times I felt misled because, you know, okay, yes, I see your point about this is the concept art. This is how you're supposed to feel. You're supposed to put imagination into it. But, okay, like the NES era? All the crap that came out during NES era, like, it was such a gamble to figure out if that game was even playable. So, you know, that's where I was just very upset. And it wasn't even because of the age back then, because stuff that was released on Atari had very straightforward covers that showed you basically what the game was, you know? And so it was just very unique to specifically NES, that yeah, the NES box art.
Putty Pigeon had some great art.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, like, so you linked that. I'm very happy you linked the Pitfall cover. I love those Atari covers that have the rainbows on them, just because that is, like, for as much as I hate branding, like, you could tell exactly what you were looking at. Like, oh, here's what fits us in, and I put this weird emphasis on, not weird, this totally appropriate emphasis on motion, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I love Atari era box art specifically for that reason.
I was just going to say, and then just for my favorite, I don't know. I don't really pay attention to box art anymore because I pretty much just download stuff because I'm a console gamer now, or not console, PC gamer. So yeah. I don't pay attention to box art because box art's not really a thing. I pay attention more to the concept art when it's in its wonderful Steam Early Access beta. Whatnot.
Yeah.
So.
Yep, that's right. It is pretty sad that you know, video game box art is going the way of album art, because there's some really great art, period, that comes out of album art.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh well. I'll go ahead and take this. Dan Craig, he writes in saying my favorite is the Resident Evil remake on GameCube. Showing the zombie getting ready to bite Jill in front of that window there. That is pretty good. It's very indicative of what happens in the game. And also, it's a very well-composed shot. Guys, I'm so excited. That's going to be the Halloween game for WoF.
Nice.
Yeah. Like, that remake is one of my favorite games ever. It's so good.
I'm going to have to, like, get my GameCube and see if I can track down a copy, because I've never played, like, any of the Resident Evil games back when it was survival horror.
Right. That's real good, man. It's definitely one of the scariest games I've ever played.
It sounds pretty spooky.
Yeah.
Especially since Halloween's only a month away.
I know.
Spooky.
Yep. And then Dan Craig goes on to say, my least favorite is Zelda Wind Waker, GameCube. Yuck. I'm struggling to see what's offensive about the GameCube one.
I think it's just kind of a boring shot. I mean, it's just like, we really like the color gold.
Well, that's been Zelda since the beginning. Like, Zelda's cover art has always been, here's the name of the game against gold background.
Yeah, it just, I don't know. Just me, this one just seems kind of boring.
Mm-hmm. This one's particularly offensive for some reason.
Well, I don't know. I think also, I mean, especially since the Zelda series could have awesome but art, I don't know. I can kind of see where it's coming from.
Yeah.
I'm actually pulling up now because I'm wondering the original Zelda box art.
Yeah. Well, it's offensive to me about the, if there is anything offensive about the Wind Waker one, is that it kind of mixes its styles a little bit too much. So if it was just the Zelda Wind Waker and then kind of that distinctive style boat with the crazy iconic water underneath it, that would have been fine. However, they also have the crazy sunrise starburst effect going on in the background, like at a you know, kind of like a at a 50% opacity. And oh, here's just a ghost image of Link on his boat, the same boat that you see in the logo.
Yeah, so, I think that's more the area.
Yeah.
Although I do have to say, I looked up the original Zelda fan art, and I had forgot about the cool like shield with the hearts and the keys and stuff. That was pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Zelda's generally been pretty solid. Ben, how about you, favorite and least favorite?
So I don't know if I have a least favorite, but I have three favorites that I brought.
Okay.
So as far as my favorite ones go, this one always gets mentioned, but Shadow of the Colossus, I do really like the cover of that because it kind of puts across everything that's going to be in the game. It's like isolation and outnumbered against a big guy and just light. So, you know, main elements of the game there, pretty simplified. The style is pretty uniform.
Love that color and texture.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Another one I want to throw out is with Modern Warfare 2. I really like the Capitol building in the background being destroyed because it's something that you don't notice until you've played through the game, I think.
Yeah.
Like once somebody mentions it, it's obvious what it is, you know, but yeah, I didn't see that until completing the game. So I really like that was like a little Easter egg. It's kind of hard to find that. And then my last one is something that isn't yet a cover, but hopefully one day will be a cover.
Why do I know what it already is? Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
No, well, I don't. I don't know what it already is.
Well, while that's loading up for me, I just wanted to comment that Shadow of the Colossus and Modern Warfare 2 have very striking similarities in composition and all different kinds of elements.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny because they are very, very similar.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like what you like, apparently.
That is very true. They definitely have very similar color palettes at the very least.
Well, and then composition, too. I mean, you've got the little guy on the horse at the bottom on Shadow of Colossus, and then you've got the dudes in the background in the same place on the other thing. There's a building in the background on both of them.
Yeah.
Dramatic lighting. Yeah, there's a lot in common. Yeah,
like the crazy brush fire that's behind him is kind of in the same place that slash of light is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Huh. That's crazy, Ben.
Spooky.
Ben, right. Basically what we're saying is that your buying habits are entirely determined by subliminal box art advertising.
I'm so weak.
Just take anything and run it through a sepia filter.
I love Instagram. So the third one, as I said, it's not official art, but it's a concept art by a fan for Borderlands 3. And, you know, so the first one has one hand against the psycho's head. Second one has two hands against the psycho's head. So in the third one, it has two arms and a foot against the psycho's head. Just look it up. It's great.
I do kind of like the Borderlands, particularly the first one. I feel like, I don't know, I'd say it's my favorite, but I feel like that's a very, like, witty and kind of catchy way to do that design.
Pretty striking, yeah. I also want to do one other shout-out for Left 4 Dead, since all three words are in the title, or in the picture that's in there. So.
Yep, it's a left hand, it's dead, and they have the numbers, right?
Four, yep.
Yep. Yeah,
I really want to know what they're going to do when they get to Left 4 Dead 4.
They need to get to a third game first.
Yeah.
But
No. John and I were talking. I think the answer is that Valve is afraid of the third game, so they should just jump straight to Left 4 Dead 4.
No, it should just be a reboot that is just Left 4 Dead, except 4 is underlined.
Bolded.
And the only difference is how you say it. Left there, 4 Dead. Go, Ben.
Another backstory is originally when they shot the cover art for that, they had a right hand on it. And then when they were showing it off to like fans and stuff, someone was like, oh, if you use the other hand, it would have all the words in the title. Yeah. So they went back and reshot it just for that.
Nice.
You have to love that dedication to like getting the thing right. Mm-hmm. Like that's a man. And who cares if that reshoot delayed the game by another 4 months?
Wasn't that cover art also like one of the big things that is for one of the stories I didn't do for the brief is that you can just now get Left 4 Dead 2 Uncensored in the Australia?
Yeah, yeah.
The cover art Uncensored?
The cover art was one of the things they griped about.
Yeah. Well, it's a severed hand in some regions, right? Or am I thinking of the Saw movies? I'm thinking of the Saw movies.
Okay.
Yeah. Who hasn't read a response yet?
I have not.
What's GeoLoss?
Let me navigate.
Watch me as I navigate.
What? GeoLoss says, Modern Warfare 4? Wow. GeoLoss says, MechWarrior 4. Robots, explosions, vengeance. What more do you want? I really like that cover. It kind of reminds me of the any novel ever I read in high school.
it's evocative of an era and an aesthetic.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it, like he said, it's a cover that you know exactly what you're getting.
Mm-hmm. Well, in my case, like when I see the thumbnail, it looks like the guy's dancing. So it's completely different on my end over here.
But can you say it's worse?
I think it'd be even more awesome if you were dancing as a mech warrior.
Yeah, you didn't know this is a rhythm game?
Yeah,
it's a rhythm game.
It's a great way to throw off your assailants.
He's just dancing on the graves of his enemies.
There you go.
I mean, he's firing straight up into the air.
David, have you given an answer for yours?
No, I have not. I'd say first off, I really like the cover art for Magic of Vietnam. I'm going to link both. The cover art it's parodying, and then the actual cover art.
Okay, wait, what do you mean, Magica Vietnam? What?
Yeah, so the game Magica started coming out with just crazy expansions.
Okay.
So after Battlefield Bad Company came out with Battlefield Company Vietnam, they basically then released Magica Vietnam because, quote, every game's getting a Vietnam sequel.
Yeah.
And so they did it, for a while there, I don't know if it's still the thing, the kind of the motif in all the Battlefield covers was some guy with sort of this, like, flame effect over him.
Yeah,
and in Magica, a prominent thing is that it's basically all friendly fire all the time, so you're constantly incinerating yourself. Mm-hmm. So their cover art is just the mage caught on fire.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that. And I'd say the other one I really enjoyed and I cannot pronounce is the NES, American NES cover for Magic of...
Shirazad?
Yes.
The guy who wrote Arabian Nights.
Oh, is that who that is?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So the game itself is actually a really cool game. It's kind of a weird action RPG thing, but it's straight up Arabian Nights type stuff. But I really like the cover. I don't know.
I feel like we should mention in the Magic of Vietnam that in the background, there is a chopper fighting a dragon.
Yeah. That's, right. I was waiting for you to get to that. I didn't know if you were going to circle back.
No, it's not really out of context at all. Like, you were literally dual wielding fireball spells and M16s.
Hmm.
Also, I have to interject a quick correction. Shirazad is a female, and it's a character in that 1001 Nights who is the storyteller. She's the storyteller who tells the tales, and she's doing it in order to prolong her life. Okay. So that way she's not killed. So she keeps on telling stories, so that way it puts off her being killed.
Yeah. Just I know just enough to be dangerous, Jala. Thank you for correcting me. I said that out loud, and then I repeated it again with confidence.
And that's the secret.
Yep.
So then dragons and helicopters were fighting.
Yes.
Yes. That was actually one of the stories. So and finally I'd say this is a little bit not video game, but the cover of any choose your own adventure book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much, especially the ones that were all from that that same publisher.
Yeah.
That kind of had like the pastel covers, and then the actual art was inside of a little frame. Yep. We all remember those.
I'm thinking of Goosebumps.
Yeah. Also good.
Yeah, well, the Goosebumps ones all had foil. The Choose Your Own Adventure ones were color foil.
Ooh.
On the cover. Yeah. So I'll go ahead and finish this out with our last response, and then I'll do mine. Yeah, so Christopher Schley writes in saying his favorites, Shadowgate, Castlevania 3, Dracula's Curse, and Grey Matter, a Jane Jensen adventure game, and Arcanum. All of those are fantastic, especially Shadowgate and Castlevania 3. Man, that Castlevania 3 art is something else. It looks like let's say mid-era Frank Frazetta. It's pretty crazy. But yeah, Shadowgate especially. And he says that his contender for the least favorite is, he says, it pains me to say this since it's one of my favorite games of all time, but Planescape Torment's cover is terrible. As amazing as some of the concepts can be when thought about, it's a shame they decided to just go with the manlier but equally wrinkly Mick Jagger as their cover art.
Wait, what?
I have to agree, because when I first saw the cover a long, long time ago, I'm like, huh, oh, D&D game, cool. Maybe I'll, no, not that cover. Mm-mm. So I only went back and played it after you guys did it for WoF.
Yeah. No,
I'm glad I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like he's a Rasta zombie who looks like he would be more like it, like he would be more at home in the in Corpse Killer, that crazy FMV light gun game for the Sega Saturn. Like it's
weird cover.
Yeah. Like it's pretty bad. Like the Nameless One is a great character. But, yeah. You know, there are several more. Like, they could have, like, led with, like, just put up the Queen of Blades on there. Like, that would be a great image to lead with. You know, especially because...
That was on everything from Planescape ever. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's really recognizable for anybody who knows anything about Planescape.
Yeah.
So.
Doubling back around to why Wind Waker was so terrible... It looks like Dan accidentally did a follow-up on the previous week's post where he showed a side-by-side of the Japan version of the HD remake of Wind Waker versus the U.S. one, where the U.S. one, everything's gold, whereas in the Japanese one, water is blue.
Yeah.
And he says, and they still fucked it up. 10+ years later, what's with the pissy yellow cover? Japan did it better.
Well, there is a cheat code in the U.S. version that turns it into a piss ocean.
Yes. Which totally changes, like, a lot about that game.
Yeah.
But no, so I think what that then says, yeah, what he was going with is not so much a fan of the whole, like, rising sun gold overlay effect.
Yeah. Huh. So. And I'll go into mine. As I mentioned at the beginning of this, the divide between the Japanese cover art and the American cover art is something of great contention for me, especially in one of my favorite series, the Silent Hill games. So I put the links in there a little while back. But if you compare the Japanese Silent Hill 2 cover art to the American Silent Hill 2 cover art, the Japanese art has the 3x3 grid of the red save notes against the grimy wall with some like crazy writing on the back of it. And then just like Silent Hill 2, it's like nice and understated and moody and actually like, I don't know, emblematic of that game to me, just because that is such an important moment when you see those. And you know, has like this air of mystery as opposed to the American version, which looks like the cover to a Stained album. Which is just
about that.
Which is just like Angela, it's Angela from that cutscene where she's laying on the apartment floor staring at that knife, wondering if she should do bad things. except with a bunch of like Illustrator filters put over her, and then like a crazy metal font, Silent Hill 2, except it's black and it's covered in white because like one of those is a more artful thing than the other. Ugh, God, like once you start seeing filters, you just can't stop seeing them.
Filters all the way down.
Yeah. And in a similar vein, the like similar concept but entirely different execution, the Silent Hill 4 The Room cover art. In Japan, it's like a really grimy image of the of Henry's front door to his apartment with the locks kind of like all over the place. It's a very hopeless image, and it's really it's really indicative of like, oh, you're trapped in this apartment, like there's no way out. And it's a very striking monolithic kind of composition, and it has a ghost image of Walter, the primary antagonist, kind of laid over it, right? Cut to the American version, which has the door, except with a bunch of light shining through the cracks. It's an entirely different door, and everything is like oversaturated and red. And instead of having a ghost image of Walter, there's just an image of like a crazy screaming zombie guy. So I couldn't decide.
You don't remember that character, crazy screaming zombie guy?
Well, he's in there. He's one of the ghosts that you fight. Like he's one of the 19 victims. But he's not like a remarkable one. Like just go with Walter. Like he's a
spoiler alert. He was just sleeping.
There was a hole here, but now it's a chained over door. Man. I don't even know. Like that, it's really upsetting even to watch this. And in terms of like missed opportunities, I really, really wish that Final Fantasy would have used more of Amano's concept art for their covers. Like that crazy.
Can you link some of that?
Yeah, I can go ahead and do that. But like once you see it, you usually find them in the logos of different Final Fantasy games. But Amano has this very distinctive, almost like very ethereal, watercolory slash free-flowing pencil art kind of designs. There's one of my favorite images from Final Fantasy X, which is like, that is far better than anything they put on Final Fantasy X, which is, oh, here's Meg Ryan standing in an ocean with a water sword, as opposed to this like awesome blue and gold composition that just kind of looks like you would see it like painted on silk somewhere.
Didn't the like one and two, or at least the remakes, didn't they use kind of this sort of style?
Yeah, they dip into and out of it, but then they just jump right back to let's do a CG render of somebody on there.
Yeah, I know. Like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I don't know. Like, the role that box art plays is, you know, diminishing, as we kind of said. But I don't know if that's exactly a bad thing, because usually what it, you know, having worked in video game retail, you just kind of notice like, oh, this is a cover that is designed as cynically as possible to get somebody to pay attention to it on a shelf. And like everything about a game and the way that it presents itself, from the screenshots that are chosen to even the way that the title is stylized, is a form of marketing. Mm-hmm. But like cover art is definitely one of the more crass ways that, you know, you can take what a game is and kind of like twist it into this ugly thing, a la Ico or a la Silent Hill 2.
And this kind of brings us around to the initiating question that Dennis posted with BioShock Infinite's cover art.
Yeah.
Where they had one concept for cover art that was more on the artistic side, and they kind of botched that and put on a more marketing sort of cover art and put that on the front.
Yeah.
I thought he was putting them on because I think they're both excellent.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I would say I feel like they're both at... I would say it's actually better that way, because it's kind of the two different sides of the game.
Describe. What do you mean?
Well, just the fact that, you know, the game has, you know, some real artistic things, but the point of the game is just Booker coming in and wrecking stuff up. That's kind of the message of the game, is the degree to which him solving all problems with the verb shoot screws up what, like three generations of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know. I actually like both the covers.
I wish Booker didn't look like so much of a doofus on this cover. like with his rolled up sleeves on his like suit jacket and his ascot and just the ace bandage that he has wrapped around his hand, his shotgun hand. Like, I don't know. Like, that's my biggest problem is that he doesn't look like Booker.
The ace bandage kind of makes sense, though.
Yeah, because that's from where you get stabbed through the hand.
All right. We're going to...
Okay. All right.
So, wait, what?
Nothing. Let's not call attention to it. So, thank you, everybody, for writing in. That is, I always appreciate seeing good and bad box art. If you would like to participate in this, generally the questions go up on Tuesday afternoons at facebook.com/thelevelpodcast. And all input is welcome, especially, you know, on these multimedia ones. You guys taking the extra time to put in the links. It's really appreciated.
The grind.
It is time for the grind. And since we're going long again, I might actually... enforce the one game grind as we have been doing in the past. So I will throw off to you, Ben.
Yes, and I will do you one better. I have a zero game grind because I went on vacation this last weekend. So
you did. Where'd you go?
I went to Denver, Colorado.
Hmm.
Nice.
So I visited family and drank some tasty, tasty beer.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yay! So I know the Great Divide is up there, but what else is in Denver in terms of beer?
They apparently have like 500 breweries within the city. Wow. But the only other significant one we went to was Denver Beer Co., which was also pretty good. But yeah, Great Divide was definitely the best one that I went to. So that they have amazing beer. But anyway, Watch Dogs is still marinating in the back. I will probably finish that this coming week. So yeah.
I actually managed to get it working again on my computer.
Oh, yeah?
So I might actually continue playing it now.
All right. Yeah. We can talk about the paper-thin storyline next week.
Yes, we can. Oh, man. David, how about you?
Sure. I feel like I should at least say Dennis lent me his Vita, so I've been messing around with that, but I'm going to talk about that more when maybe he's here.
Yep.
So the big thing, Jolly and I guess yesterday, completed... Chris and Pierce's campaign in Resident Evil 5?
Six?
Whatever. Resident Evil, the nonsensical one.
You're going to have to narrow that down. Yeah.
I feel like there's the degrees. Like, each one they make is so nonsensical that retroactively makes the previous ones make sense. But I don't know. I think my overall feeling of this is that the campaign proves that there's a untapped potential for a zombie apocalypse buddy cop film. Because that's to a significant degree what the game is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The whole thing is just so blatantly like action-y. It's kind of funny.
I'm getting too undead for this shit.
Yeah, I mean you pretty much any action you can action gets actioned.
Yeah. See, it's funny that you read buddy cop into that because I read like why don't you guys just fuck already into it?
Ooh. Well, yeah.
Every other fan fiction writer.
Not even that. Like I'm not a fan. Okay. if fandom upsets me. However, like it's pretty egregious in some places.
Yeah, I would say particularly Pierce's side of that is pretty. Yeah. Like yeah.
We can speak about it with some level of sensitivity. Says the guy who said, "Why don't you guys just fuck already?" But no, I mean we can say it even in like action movies there is a little there's a degree of like homoeroticism built into it.
And I guess that's to me why I said buddy cop thing is that's kind of what it struck me as is the sort of that sort of element of like buddy films
mm-hmm.
where yeah. it's it's. I don't know, like both characters struck me as being intended to be straight, but it very much came across like in buddy films, like that, you know, there's definitely a much deeper relationship than you would normally associate with two same-sex friends. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And I don't want people to misunderstand me when I say like laughing at this. I'm more, it's not like, hey, homosexuality is a funny thing. It's more, right. It's more like, oh, this is not, this is either not intended or, you know, done in a tongue-in-cheek fashion. Either way, right. it can come across as like a weird dynamic in media.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah. And, I would say like overall and I think it, you know, that the whatever dynamic was there was, you know, very entertaining and very I think pretty good. But yeah, it was a very interesting you know, it was definitely different. The way they ended that up, I had mixed feelings on. I also have to say, like, you know, getting near to where, you know, maybe Ada's campaign will completely change things, but I feel like they've gone a little bit off the rails, even for Resident Evil, in terms of, like, the zombies now are straight up supernatural.
That sounds spooky.
Are they?
I'm really trying to put in some groundwork for our Halloween episode.
just, do you want us to make a spooky supercut? Like, just find that you've been sowing the spooky seeds.
Ooh.
Yeah, I'm just talking about like the point where like they can chew electric Tesla coils.
Yeah,
like that's a little.
Well, that's just him, awesome. Though.
What?
That's just one particular. Character though who can
right.
do, who can
I'm,
do
I'm still saying yeah. though I still feel like it I don't know I but I yeah, I'll stand by I'd be interested to get maybe Jala's feelings on this. I stand by that I think playing their campaign last was the right choice. I feel like they really they tend to do are a lot of times playing a support role for the other characters, whereas the other characters don't really ever do support for them in the same way. And similarly, they often serve as the behind-the-scenes deus ex machina for the other characters. So I feel like playing as the other characters, it's better to like have these things happen and not immediately know why. The other thing I'd say is I felt like having the over-the-top action at the end sort of felt kind of like a payoff, whereas I felt like having it in the middle of the experience would just be a little whiplashy.
Hmm.
But
yeah, I can see that viewpoint. When I first played the game through, I played it in the order in which they show up in the menu. So I did Leon, and then I did Chris, and then after that, Jake, and then Ada. And Ada last definitely is irritating, because Ada's is the weakest campaign. So you will not be excited about that aspect, but a lot of things will make sense storyline-wise that wouldn't make sense until after you played all the rest of it. So that's sure. unfortunate.
Well, here's don't you have to play all three of them to get Ada's unlocked?
I don't recall offhand.
At the very least, that was the case when I played it. They may have patched it to make her campaign available. But like hers definitely, to me, comes across as an epilogue that is meant to fill in the last cracks and like seal up any possible plot holes they might have had.
Which is what they did in Resident Evil 4.
Oh, yeah.
But the whole game is a plot hole.
Yes, I know. That's, I mean, like their attempt, anyway. I didn't say they succeeed.
Nuking two major cities will fill in any plot hole.
Well, note that I played that game more than anything else on Steam. So, you know, I played the hell out of it, but that doesn't mean I can't, you know, poke at it.
Yeah.
I know. I would say
it's ridiculous.
One other thing I think is this game isn't real, like, really all that character driven or all that like deep characters, but to the degree that it's in the game. Jake probably has the most character development. So I feel like if you played Chris's campaign first, you very directly see like before and after version of him. And I feel like then it would be less interesting him kind of developing over the course of his campaign. Although to be fair, it's not exactly particularly dramatic or particularly well written development.
Right.
So
yeah. Well, it's predicated on an off screen loss. They like very much like never lead a squad because they're going to die and you're going to become an alcoholic wreck. Like that is the entirety of where he starts, which is entirely contrived. So any development feels just a little bit unearned.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. That whole thing struck me as a little, I don't know. I felt like the idea had some merit. In general, I think it's a little bit weird that, like, I don't know, like, I'm not saying I want, like, every video game to be, like, you know, Spec Ops The Line PTSD the game, but it does seem a little bit weird that there's all these characters that, like, experience horrifying stuff and fine. So, like, I liked drawing that in. It just wasn't well done.
Yeah.
But one thing I did want to get your feeling on, and I guess this is innately spoiler. I don't know. How was the giant zombie skull monster going to end the world?
You know, I really don't have any recollection of that of that particular part of it.
It's the end boss for the Chris and Piers campaign.
And it's supposed to be like Ada's ace in the hole.
You mean?
And it's basically just a giant monster. It's like, we've already established that the U.S. government will nuke anything for just about any reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's frustrating because I can't correct you on who Ada is. And it's also frustrating because like pretty much any between Resident Evil 5 and Resident Evil 6, really the final boss and the final threat is, and now I will infect the world. You know, like that, yeah. that's pretty much it is my recollection. That said, I played this over a year and a half ago. And by that point in Chris's campaign, I really wasn't paying attention enough.
So. I was going to say, you could even leap on Resident Evil 4 with that as well.
Yeah.
It's just...
Yeah, and again, I don't know. I feel like that's the weakest part of the story. I still, my favorite part of like all of these is the bioterrorism angle.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can see that.
Which gets a little bit crazy because, you know, if you think about, like, at the very least, like, my favorite entries in the series, specifically 1, 2, 3, and then... Code Veronica, it's almost entirely accidents that cause this to happen, or it's like a plan backfiring as opposed to like a megalomaniacal person who, you know, wants to end the world for some reason. It's like, Umbrella is like a cartoonish evil corporation with no ethics. However, that's like ending the world. It does not run toward their actual goals, right?
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is I would prefer get rid of End the World and just be like, hey, terrorists are using these as pseudo-conventional weapons, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
Like, I think what interests me is just the concept of, like, zombies as weapons.
Yeah, so you want it to be Resident Gear.
Yes. which is probably part of why I like the... Chris campaign maybe a little bit more than most people, because I mean that's definitely what it's at least angling towards.
Yeah. So Jala, are you going to run him through Ada's campaign?
Yeah. Whenever we get that far, we will be doing that as well. And since that one's pretty short, hopefully we can get through that one faster than the others.
Yeah.
So.
Any final thoughts on that, David?
Yes, just naming your company Neo Umbrella might not be a good move.
let's just own it. It's Blackwater 2, guys.
Electric Boogaloo.
Oh, Jala, how about you?
Okay, I played Mighty No. 9, but that really, it's only one level that's out, and it's super beta, so I don't really, and there's not enough that's different from Mega Man for that to even qualify as really have played a game, so I'm not going to talk about that.
Just a real quick question.
Maybe when they add more.
Mm-hmm. Which vintage of Mega Man?
Well, you have dash, you have shooting. What the difference, the main difference mechanically is that you shoot enemies and they weaken to where they destabilize, and then you dash into them to absorb them, and you can absorb health or power-ups to your defense or to your weapon by absorbing enemies. And a lot of times the only way you can kill your enemies, even your regular guys, is by dashing into them and absorbing them. Hmm. So it's kind of like a weird, you know, kind of, I don't know, I guess Mega Man X era, like back when it was 2D. Because, you know, kind of the later era where they had all the Sigma viruses and stuff like that or whatnot. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But, anyway, it otherwise plays pretty standard to a Mega Man game where you shoot and you dash and you jump. And that's it. Like, all the enemies act the same. I did, however, play, and I'm going to talk about two teeny indie games because I don't have much to say about either of them, and I played them kind of together for a reason. Ballpoint Universe and Yet It Moves. And Ballpoint Universe is an exploration and spaceship shooter game where all the art assets were drawn with ballpoint pen.
Yeah.
It's done by Arachnid Games. The environments and creatures are really expressive and imaginative. But the gameplay itself is pretty standard. I mean, it's kind of like Mario without enemies. You jump around, you explore stuff, you get golden sketches. But then you have an ink ship, which reminds me kind of Kingdom Hearts, where they had the gummy ship where you could upgrade it and do all this different stuff. And then there are parts where you can go through and fight enemies and whatever. And so that's basically what that is. It's actually really cute, and it's all about these little doodles. And I scarred myself irreparably, I have to tell this story, because while I was wandering around thinking about this, you know, preparing for the show, I suddenly thought of Cool World, about doodles don't have sex with noids, and then I just scarred myself, and so I don't know if I can ever play this game again. But anyway, and then because the art is very similar, I picked up And Yet It Moves and played that because I had it from some humble bundle or another. And it's an indie puzzle platformer that basically looks like paper collage. And you guide your character around and keep him alive from all these different hazards by turning the world around. And that's about all I have to say about that. The thing is that the name of it, And Yet It Moves, makes me think it's going to be a horror game. But then I get this little paper puzzler and I'm like, okay, well.
Yeah,
I was thrown off. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's it. Really short, little, cute indie games and scarring irreparably emotionally.
The existence of Cool World is scarring to you.
Well, in this particular instance, definitely.
Yeah. And Yet It Moves is one of those games that everybody seems to have because of Humble Bundles. Like, you know, mm-hmm. you know how they will do the, okay, you'll get these six games, and then maybe in a couple weeks, we'll add another one. It's usually a bunch of games from previous bundles, which is fine. But it's also usually one of the ones from an earlier bundle, which is this. So I've had this, and I've had it for a good long while. I'm intrigued by the premise, which is, like, you rotate the stage by 90 degrees. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can, like, stop boulders from rolling toward you and stuff, and you solve puzzles. But the jumping is so floaty.
It's very floaty, and then, too, you have to be careful because if you jump too far, then you go splat and you die. Ugh. So
I really don't like fall damage in
it is fall damage.
If you jump too far, you go splat. I feel like that
so you
needs
have to
be like a public service announcement. Like, if I ever own a company, that will be like the safety poster on the wall.
Oh, hey. So you're basically going to have Portal posters everywhere. So.
Yes. Except in Portal, you can jump as far as you want, and you don't go splat.
And you get $40.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like the ballpoint pen one. It's like Trapper Keeper the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. And yeah. It's a lot of fun. Just the art itself is a lot of fun, and literally what drove me to play the both of them is just the art.
Yeah.
So
I've actually used the Ballpoint Universe game. Like, I've taken screenshots of that as reference at work. Because one of the things that I do is I'm an art director, and so a staggering number of my work is influenced. My direction is influenced. Like, oh, just do something that looks like this one game. And so, yeah, like Ballpoint Universe sticks out for me because of that, because I don't much care for the game, but it is a beautiful ass game.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on either of those?
Nope.
Cool. And I will finally do mine, which is the Shadowgate remake.
Woo!
Yeah. It's badass, guys. However, just use the classic soundtrack. I mean, like the new orchestrated ones are nice. Like, you know, those songs are good and ambient, and they found their way into my, I'm working music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for being atmospheric, and they have those melodies, but it takes them a really long time to like ramp up to them. And so, like, that's one of the bigger bummers about that, which is like, oh, you like made this just a little bit too high fantasy and subtle. I will just go back to the NES tracks, which are entirely Hook. It's like 100%. Like, this is as good as NES music gets. Right?
It's like the Kanye of NES music.
Pretty much. No. Yeah. Yeah. But in general, I really like it. So it starts out with this crazy ass opening cinematic that like talks about this this journey through like the blood-strewn fields of Karamir to get to the mountains of untrespassable spark spires and stuff. Like, it really, really plays it up. I'm not sure for comedy, because I know there is, like, a canon built around Shadowgate, like, between, like, any supplemental books that came out around it and then Shadowgate 64. Like, these kingdoms do exist in this weird little universe that they've created for themselves. But it's hard to read it as anything aside from, like, the way that I first took the opening cutscene from Dark Souls, like, and Seath the Scaleless was like, oh, fuck you. There's no dragon called Seath the Scaleless. But it's like crazy over dramatic. But then you pick up a skull that talks to you and like acts as your tutorial. And so the graphical presentation is okay. One thing that I don't like about it, because everything is like really painterly, it's kind of hard to pick out what is interactable. Whereas when it was pixel art, there was, you know, just like less information to parse. So you could actually see like, oh, that's actually sticking out as part of the background, as opposed to like, well, this skull that I need is really well rendered against this. So well, in fact, that it doesn't look like it, you know, is pick upable. It looks like a background element, which is to one degree, a compliment to how good the art is in general, that it all looks like of a whole. But also speaks to a flaw in the design, which is like, make your stuff stick out a little bit more, especially, you know, in a game like this where every little detail matters. Like, if you don't pick up the amulet of Amon-Kur Zorbis in this one hall, you will just die instantly for no reason later on. You know?
Huh.
Yeah. And it is a Shadowgate game. Did I say that right? Shadowgate ass Shadowgate game. There we go.
Shadowgate punk?
Yeah. Which is to say, you know, like it maintains the structure and kind of the ethic of the original for the NES and for the Mac, to the point where like I've died several times and I have played through Shadowgate a couple of times now and I consider myself to have memorized it. So what I think is like on normal mode, they've actually just added in new puzzles. So it's just enough of a new experience to really like have that experience play against you, just like in Resident Evil, the remake. So I'm having fun with that because it's not just a rote repetition. However, it's giving me a little bit more trouble than I have anticipated. You guys know what Shadowgate is, right?
Actually, no. Yes.
Ben?
No, I don't.
Okay. Shadowgate was it was one of a series of games done for first the Mac by I forget the like ICOM is the name of the developer and publisher, and then they were ported over to the NES. They're first-person adventure games that place a very heavy emphasis on, you know, solving puzzles or dying and doing things in the exact right order.
Lots of dying.
Yeah, lots of dying.
Choose your adventure type thing.
Pretty much, that would be that'd be a fantastic analog.
A point-and-click adventure, perhaps?
Yes, it is a point-and-click adventure, except with very unforgiving. It's, you know, it's very unforgiving.
Point-and-pray adventure?
Pretty much, yeah. It's like point-and-hope. Just point-and-hope. The other game, like the other notable game that's in this series is Uninvited. I did a Hexcrank article about it, and then there's also Deja Vu, which I think was the first of these games to be developed, and that one is kind of like a film noir detective story.
I liked that one, although I never got anywhere in it when I was little.
Yeah, I like that one a lot too, except it's like its grand meta puzzle is a little bit tricky, which is you have to always be cognizant of which evidence exonerates you and which evidence implicates you.
What makes me very happy about it is the fact that it's like, it begins with you in a bathroom, and it's like, you wake up in a bathroom, there's blood on your collar, and you have no idea who you are!
Yep.
Like, what?
Yeah. It's a Jackie Chan awesome. Movie.
Well, it's kind of like, one of the games I've been playing is Gravity Rush. I really like your character has amnesia, and one of the first characters you meet is like, you have amnesia? It's just like the start of all those awesome fantasy novels.
Yeah. Well, Deja Vu is great because that was a noir pastiche in an age when noir was not overdone.
Ah.
Yeah. So it had that going for it, that it wasn't drowned out by its contemporaries. But yeah, this remake is great. So they funded it on Kickstarter, and it is a wonderful little kind of like experience, especially if you have the old music on like that. Like that is such an important part of this. To the extent that my ringtone is now the Hall of Mirrors track. Yeah, really happy with that. Just in general. So it is kind of a nostalgia bomb. I'm kind of excited to try out the different difficulty levels, which is I think that it adds or removes puzzles and removes kind of like layers of hints around it. So I think that this is one that is kind of meant to be gone through several times with a different experience each time. So yeah.
Cool.
Any questions about that?
Actually sounds kind of cool.
Yeah. To answer Jolly's question about where it's available, just go to, it's on Steam. It's like 15 bucks or something like that. I don't know.
Is it early access or is it actually released?
No, it is. It is a full. It is. It is an actual ass game.
Oh yay! AIG. Those are rare these days. I hear.
Ugh, sorry. I don't know if I sound like an old man when I'm saying like nothing is complete anymore. Yeah,
that's a fair grievance.
In that voice.
Andy Rooney. Have you ever noticed how nothing is actually sold as a complete product anymore? Yeah, it's 20 bucks, but I would say it is entirely worth that. Cool. You guys want to button it up?
Do it.
Let's.
The credit. So that was level number 74. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And thank you, Jolliffe, for picking back up with us and covering for Dennis as he is out celebrating. I think, you know, he's announced this on social media, his third wedding anniversary.
Woo! Yay!
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. So hard to believe that was 3 years ago, but we are incredibly happy for him and his lovely wife. What can people do in terms of like network-wide things? I already talked about the Portland Retro Games Expo thing. Speaking to Watch Out for Fireballs for a second, as you listen to this, you have 1 week left to back us on Patreon and participate in our autumn adventure game poll. So just like we did for the summer RPG, where people chose to have us play Suikoden 2, and it was really good. We are opening our autumn adventure game up for everybody. So your choices are I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, Riven, the sequel to Myst, Sanitarium, and Grim Fandango. Any of those stick out to you guys? I want to hear how that rolls for you.
How well do you know the puzzles from Riven?
back of my hand. Insofar as some of them are randomized, so it's hard to, like, you can't just go and solve it right out of the gate, like in Myst.
Okay, because I was going to say, like, I know, like, does it have the same, like Myst style, the, like, figure out base whatever number systems and stuff?
Yeah, this is the one that actually introduced that, so you have to know a base 25, you have to figure out a base 25 numeral system.
Okay, because just if you didn't know it by the back of your hand, just seeing you guys sit there and try to figure that out would be pretty entertaining.
Yeah. But it's great because, you know, like base 25 just coincides to the alphabet. So people get hung up on that without realizing. What's that?
Doesn't need to be base 26?
There's something weird with the way that the NEE alphabet works. But like that is laid out to you, like. One of the great things about that game is as you're going around, you actually get exposed to like teaching materials. And so you learn the alphabet and the numeral system by way of actually like seeing this stuff as it's taught to little kids in the in the society.
As opposed to Bioshock, where you get exposed to learning about hypercapitalism as it's taught to little kids.
Yeah. So I'm really excited about all of those. My favorite one is winning right now. I don't want to paint a target on its back, but if you're listening and if that is of any interest to you, just go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv and kick us a couple of bucks. It is very much appreciated, and you can vote in that poll. And that goes to support like this show and the efforts of the entire network as a whole. So all of that is appreciated as well. But for this particular show, participate in the conversation on Facebook. It's facebook.com/thelevelpodcast. And leave us a rating or review on iTunes if you have not yet done that already. Did I miss anything?
Nope.
Okay. Well, I've been Cole Ross, at Cole Ross on Twitter.
I'm David Moneysmith at Moneysmith777.
I'm Jala Prendez, or Jala Chan, on Twitter. Not at Twitter. All of Twitter.
All right.
Okay.
I do it just to throw Ben off.
I'm Ben at Merkelizer on or in or at Twitter.
And
around Twitter. I hang out with Twitter sometimes.
And stick around after the credits music to hear us talk about the title. All right, so usually there's a clear winner, but today there is not. So I'm just going to read them in the order that they came out to me, okay?
All right.
I'm too undead for this shit. Sowing spooky seeds. Resident Gear. Blackwater 2 Electric Boogaloo.
That's a tough call. I don't know.
Yeah. I like Resident Gear, but I don't want to bias anybody.
That's fine. We're not going to bias.
I feel like we've used Electric Boogaloo before.
Yeah.
I'm too undead for this shit. If I could say the title properly, that might help.
here's one that I did notice that was written below this. It was written below here, which is Ben trying to pronounce anonymity. Which is anonymity.
An anemone.
Yeah. Which is A-N-O-M-Y-M-E-T-I-E.
Yeah.
So
that's just going to annoy people's spell checks.
It is.
So, I know. I would go with either Resident Gear or the other one.
Too undead for this shit? Huh? or the other one does not add any light to this, what you effectively said.
Or too undead for this.
Okay. Ben?
I'm not...
Pressure's on, dude!
What's the second one? What's the one that got no votes?
I'm too undead for this shit. sowing spooky seeds in reference to you planning for our Halloween episode, Resident Gear, and Blackwater 2, Electric Boogaloo.
I'll vote for sowing spooky seeds so that we have no clear winner.
Okay, cool. So I'll just make this call off the air. You've all severely disappointed me.
This has been the Annoy Cole Ross episode.